would be difficult to imagine anyone more qualified to write an up-to-date account of the worldwide AIDS crisis than Elizabeth Pisani. Ms. Pisani is an infectious disease epidemiologist who's done extensive research on AIDS in Asia and Africa, and she's advised organizations including UNAIDS, the World Health Organization, and the Centers for Disease Control. Before that, she was a journalist writing for Reuters and The Economist. Her new book, The Wisdom of Whores, is just out from Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Elizabeth Pisani to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
In a review in the Philadelphia Inquirer, Carlin Romero called your book a rollicking, eye-opening, hilarious account of the underbelly of international AIDS research. Hilarious isn't the word I usually associate with AIDS and AIDS research.
Well, that's right. But remember that AIDS is the result of HIV, and HIV is a virus that you get when you're having sex or taking drugs. So actually, when you get sick, you're having fun most of the time. So
only rock and roll is left out of this equation?
That's right. And I'm tone deaf, so I'm glad that that wasn't part of my research.
It's my sense that many of the people who write about serious diseases are trying to scare or shock their readers into action. And then others on public health issues like AIDS tend to be too technical or dry to appeal to a general audience. But you've written this almost as a memoir.
Well, I think that one of the things that makes HIV interesting to me and has kept me engaged in the field for 15 years has been really the incredibly interesting people that I've met along the way. So I'm privileged to work with sex workers of all genders, with drug users, with some very dedicated public health professionals, with researchers, with some incredibly annoying bureaucrats, and some very good bureaucrats too. And across that whole spectrum of people that I've worked with, I've found good, hardworking, funny people who don't look at this as a huge tragedy, but look at this as a challenge that we can do something about. And so I try and tell their stories as much as mine.
And you've said that you were drawn into AIDS research by sex and drugs rather than concern for the future of humanity?
To be honest, yes, although I have to say that after a very long time in the field, I have become, despite myself, greatly concerned with the individual lives involved.
Although one of the things that you do here is you deal with the overstating of cases. Some people are understating, some people are overstating. You want us to understand what the real situation is.
That's right. And I should say that I don't think that anyone has deliberately made up numbers or inflated the numbers in the past. But there is a big issue about how we frame those numbers. And we have given the impression, for example, that everyone is at risk in countries where we know that everyone will never be at risk, but either to avoid stigmatizing the groups that are most at risk, or because if everyone's at risk, we get more money. We've sort of framed the numbers in that way.
But in a way, it worked in an opposite direction when we first became very aware of AIDS as a serious problem. The suggestion was that everybody in America was at risk, and every heterosexual was at risk. And then others pointed out that it was very unlikely in many cases that most of us would contract HIV. And so I think that it actually made some people who live dangerously less careful.
I'm not sure about that. I do think that the everyone is at risk thing is a balancing act. You see that the Bronx, one borough of this great city, last week decided that they were going to try and test every adult for HIV.
Isn't that a bit insulting to a lot of the people who live in the Bronx? I live a totally monogamous life, risk-free.
I think it's insulting to suggest that they have such boring lives. No, I'm just kidding. I do think it's certainly, in my point of view, from a pure public health point of view, it's a waste of money because we know that a lot of people are not at risk. On the other hand, we do have 1 in 5 gay men who come in with an HIV diagnosis being diagnosed at the same time as they already have AIDS, at which point it's really difficult for medication to work as effectively. So people who are most at risk are not getting tested enough. And I guess the Bronx's thinking is, well, if we try and destigmatize it by testing everyone, then we'll get the people who are most at risk. It's not a very cost-effective way of doing it, in my opinion.
Do you think that the fact that it is something that is connected to sex and to private activity has made people more squeamish to even talk about it or think
absolutely.
About it?
Absolutely. I think that's, 100% of the problem in most countries. We've got these two separate epidemics going on in the world. We've got one in Eastern Southern Africa, where HIV is spread by multiple sex partners in the general population, which is a behavior that a lot of the general population engage in, partly because of a history of polygamy and other things.
That's the African problem.
Yeah,
basically.
That's the African problem. And that's led to, in some countries, one in three adults being infected with this preventable fatal disease. In the rest of the world, it's confined to people who inject drugs, people who sell sex and buy it, and men who have sex with a lot of other male partners. And saying that has become so difficult that, yes, because we're so squeamish about saying it's about sex and drugs.
But also because we judge people, those kinds of activities, one reason or another. And I've seen stereotyping of Africans to the point where it's suggested that they have more sex than other people when you say it really is a matter of cultural style.
That's right. It's actually not about sheer volume of sex. It's about the number of sex partners that you have at any given time.
And since you're more likely to infect somebody in the early months, if you have a number of sex partners within the first 3 months, there you are spreading it to three different people.
That's exactly right. So if you only ever have four sex partners in your whole life, but you have those four sex partners continuously over several years and you're faithful to those four people, you're more likely to spread AIDS than if you have 20 partners in your life but only have one a year.
You're a mini epidemic, in effect. You've said that it surprised you to see yourself referred to once as an AIDS activist in a book about AIDS in Asia because you think of yourself as a nerd trying to do something sensible with the facts that are in front of you.
That's right. I crunch numbers, and then I do try to help people to turn those numbers into sensible programs, but that's not always easy to do.
So can a nerd be more effective than an activist?
I think the best possible situation is when nerds are in cahoots with activists, and I try and do that in my work. But I know that sometimes activists, for reasons of their own, are less persuaded by the data than they are by passion. And passion can drive you a very long way. What we try and do is use the numbers to drive that passion in the right direction.
You've written that you feel somewhat responsible for having helped spread bumped up information to convince the public that AIDS posed a threat to every man, woman, and child on Earth rather than to just those in high-risk groups.
That's right. When I started working with UNAIDS in the mid-90s, beginning of UNAIDS, there was so little money for HIV. We only had $250 million for all of HIV everywhere in the developing world, and we clearly needed more. But how are we going to get more for a disease that in 90% of the world is to do with sex workers, drug injectors, and gay men? So we tried to hide that a little bit by saying, if we don't do anything for these groups, then it's going to get much bigger in the general population. Unfortunately, the political message, we need to do something for high-risk groups, got lost, and we went straight to doing things for the general population, which is not very effective.
Do you think people understand it better today?
I think that scientists and people in the AIDS industry understand it very well, but now we've got all of these institutional incentives not to do the right thing because there are institutions who don't want to do icky things like sex and drugs who are getting money from the AIDS industry.
And we'll talk about the AIDS industry in the second part of our conversation. We're seeing people living a lot longer as a result of the drugs that are available. Is that actually adding to the spread of AIDS? Do they feel secure, more secure than they should?
This is a point of huge controversy. It's certainly adding to the number of people who are living with AIDS, which is a good thing in as much as they're not dying because they're on treatment. So the raw number of people living with AIDS is increasing. Unfortunately, it's increasing not just because we're keeping people alive, but also because we're failing to prevent new infections. Now, is increased treatment helping increase new infections as well? I think that the evidence that we have from particularly gay communities in rich countries is, yes, it certainly is. Because HIV and AIDS, which used to be one thing, we used to talk about HIV/AIDS. Well, now they're two separate things because we're preventing AIDS without preventing HIV.
Elizabeth Pisani has a PhD in infectious disease epidemiology. She's provided research, analysis, and policy advice to UNAIDS, the WHO, the World Bank, the CDC, and other organizations. She's written a book called The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS, published by Norton. And we will continue our conversation after this.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We're back with Elizabeth Pisani. She's written a book called The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS, published by Norton. And you have to explain that title for a book like this. I mean, I could see The Wisdom of Whores for a novel or some other kind of book.
Well, I did. One of the publishers that I went to see about it said, you know, the title, that's problematic. I said, non-negotiable. He said, that W word, wisdom, really going to put people off. So that made me laugh. It's called The Wisdom of Whores really for two reasons. One is that I've learned an awful lot from the people that I've worked with, even about my own speciality, which is epidemiology and sexual behavior research.
You say that public health workers could learn a lot if they spoke more to prostitutes?
Absolutely. Well, certainly if what you're trying to do is make life safer for prostitutes and their clients, yeah, you need to be talking to people rather than just reading medical books.
And you spoke to them all over the world. Indonesia?
Yes, worked for a long time there and was a bit confused about which gender the sex workers I was talking to were on some occasions.
They were male, female, and transgender.
Exactly.
And were they knowledgeable?
They were very sensible. They're knowledgeable about their business, as anyone who's good at their business is. I remember, but they were also knowledgeable about my business. It was a very funny incident when a transgender sex worker was over at my house and extraordinarily beautiful. And she makes pretty good money, I guess, but she was knocking back my best single malt scotch. And I was like, honey, you've got expensive tastes for someone who has three clients a week. She said, what do you mean three clients a week? And I said, well, we've just done the research and it's according to the WHO. She said, you're doing it all wrong. I said, well, let me see. I'm the expert here and let me explain to you how we do it. We do it according to the guidelines from the WHO, which I wrote. So, you know, I really am the expert. And she said, you're talking to all the dogs. I said, you're not listening to me. We have a randomized sample. She said, you're not listening to me. Any sex worker that's on the street talking to research team is a hooker who doesn't have a client. You're talking to all the dogs, so of course they don't have many clients. And I thought, oh yeah, she's right. But the other reason...
The other ones are off working.
Exactly, exactly. They're with clients. The other reason it's called The Wisdom of Whores is because I have concluded after 15 years in what is now a maybe $12 billion a year industry that most of us are selling ourselves to the highest bidder in the industry. So you could say we're all whores.
Well, can't working in the public health field, always scrambling for grants, sometimes... you know, and doing all the things that you have to do to get this money that because you believe in what you're doing, can't that also make you feel like a whore?
Absolutely it does. But now it's worse than that. It's that the money is there. The scrambling is not so difficult. There's actually so much money in the field now that people who have no interest in working with the things that we need to be working with if we want to beat HIV, which is sex and drugs, can also get hold of that money. So there are people who work in mainstream water projects and HIV or gender and HIV or agriculture and HIV. They're all putting together grants and getting part of that money.
And you call them the HIV industry.
That's right. I've been part of it and profited from it for many years now.
Is the HIV industry self-perpetuating like the military-industrial complex?
I would like to hope not, but the evidence at the moment is that, yes, that is the case. There's been, you know, I'm by no means the only critic from within the industry right now, but there's been a lot of reaction to criticism from inside the industry saying, you know, we need more money, not less. You shouldn't criticize us for spending some of the money wrong because we're spending some of it right. So there's a lot of building up of the defenses.
There has been a lot of criticism of the South African leaders, not just because of what they've been doing with Zimbabwe, but because of their AIDS, their approach to HIV/AIDS. There have been a lot of successes in Africa and Asia and South America as well. What has been the problem with Jacob Zuma and Thabo Mbeki?
I think that their problem has been the same problem that we've actually seen in the Bush administration here, denial. You know, if you don't want to recognize that most people have sex because it's fun and that people get addicted to drugs because they start off feeling good, if you don't want to actually recognize the patterns of sexual behavior which are common in your country, then you can't deal with them. And those are people who don't want to recognize what's really going on. And I would say the same of George Bush.
Well, but they differently subscribe to a theory that HIV and AIDS are not the same thing, and that AIDS is really an extreme example of chronic fatigue syndrome.
I think it's just an excuse not to have to draw a direct parallel between unprotected sex with multiple partners, an infectious sexually transmitted disease, AIDS syndrome, and death. They don't want to draw that direct line. Countries that have drawn that direct line, even in Africa, have had a much more successful response to the epidemic.
So the answer you're saying is not to tell people they can't have sex because they're going to have it anyway, but to have reasonable government programs?
That's right. I think we need to invest much more in programs that actually, first of all, treat HIV like an infectious disease, which we've ceased to do. We treat it like a development problem and do things around the edges instead of addressing the core of the problem. But we also have to look at where HIV is most likely to be spreading.
But part of the problem is that the government and NGOs can be as idealistic as they want to be. If people are on the ground are in a state of denial, refusing to accept the fact that they might be putting themselves into risky situations or refusing to have themselves tested because they suspect that they may be HIV positive. How do you get around that?
I think it is very, very difficult. I think that one of the things that we have to do, obviously, is try and reduce the stigma that's associated with it. But I do think that people on the ground do respond to their leaders. And if their leaders are giving them an excuse, a way out, if their leaders are saying that HIV doesn't cause AIDS and sex doesn't cause HIV, then we've got this issue where we've got people who are putting themselves at risk, knowing perfectly well that they're putting themselves at risk, but able to say, oh, well, I'm not at risk. You know, my president says not.
How have Ethiopia and Senegal reduced the incidence of AIDS in their countries?
They've been very, very open about the fact that it's a sexually transmitted disease. They've behaved rather differently. Senegal, being a former French colony, is much better at talking about sex and particularly much better at recognizing that prostitution exists and needs to be regulated. So prostitution is regulated and sex workers have very good access to health services, regular screening and treatment. And so Senegal, which started the response very, very early on, has never seen more than 1% prevalence in its general population. Ethiopia let it go a little bit higher, but the government has come in, is treating this like an infectious disease, is encouraging the people who are most likely to be at risk to be screened and treated, and they're doing quite well.
And Uganda is another country that's had some success.
Uganda has had some success. Unfortunately, it appears that the success in Uganda may actually be reversed at the moment, and that's in part perhaps because with this enormous influx of American money that has stressed abstinence only as an effective response, they've rather dropped the ball on the other effective responses, which was reducing the number of sex partners and using condoms.
A country like Thailand seems to be a really interesting case because many people think of Thailand as a place where there are a lot of sex workers, and you would assume there would be a serious AIDS problem.
Well, there was. HIV rose to 30% and 40% in sex workers in parts of the country before the government said, hang on a second, this is something we need to do something about, something we can do something about. They started a 100% condom use program that really targeted brothel owners. It didn't target sex workers, but it put the onus on brothel owners to make sure that there were good health and safety conditions for sex workers and to enforce condom use. And they brought new infections down to virtually nothing in commercial sex. They have, however, neglected drug users, I'm afraid to say.
Elizabeth Pisani has written a book called The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS, published by W.W. Norton. China is one of those countries that has been a bit confusing because we've heard about an explosion of AIDS in China and then accusations that the government has been censoring information. You were brought in, you were hired as a foreign expert to help China's team of epidemiologists crunch their numbers. What did you discover?
What was really interesting was, I mean, they were already doing a very, very good job, and they brought me in just sort of to rubber stamp the results. The government said they wanted to know what was really going on, and we really went for it, and we made estimates of the number of drug users, sex workers, clients in every district in China and the number who were HIV infected.
And the Chinese were willing to admit that they had sex workers.
Oh, absolutely. And we did a very, very detailed, at the technical level, we did these incredibly detailed estimates. And then we took them to the government, and the government said, we can't publish those figures. And we said, why not? You said that you were willing to be open. And so this is one part of the government talking to the other part of the government, the technical people talking to the political people. And the political people said, the numbers are too low.
People won't believe us.
People won't believe us. The numbers are too low. And I was absolutely shocked because, of course, everyone thinks that the Chinese are underplaying the numbers. And in fact, they're absolutely not doing that.
But I've heard a different story. When NPR's former Beijing bureau chief, Rob Gifford, was a guest on the show, he described sneaking into AIDS villages to hear about how people had contracted AIDS and how they were being neglected by the government.
You're talking about Henan province, I suspect, which is there was an outbreak in the mid-90s among drug injectors, among blood transfusion recipients. And that was something that was very, very bad, and it was sat on by the local government. And there's still a huge amount of resistance from local officials to recognizing the scale of the problem. But the central government has actually done mass testing now in those provinces. And I don't know when you were talking to Rob and when he was there, but in the
last... It was last year.
Okay, yeah. I mean, in the last 18 months or so, they've really stepped up programs for those people. And they now have a program called the Four Frees and the One Care, which provides free treatment and also free schooling for AIDS-affected children.
Aren't people less likely to encounter someone with full-blown AIDS today than they might have 20 years ago?
Yes, absolutely, because we're increasing the access to treatment so effectively. And so, of course, people are less scared of it. And there's a whole generation, particularly of young gay men, who've never seen AIDS.
And that was a cautionary tale in the past. We saw those rail-thin people covered with sores. And that would have scared a lot of people off of unsafe sex. Is there a problem now that we're not seeing that sort of thing today?
Well, it's hard to say that we'd like to go on seeing it. It's a fantastic thing that we're not seeing it, in as much as, you know, we do have treatments and people are able to live longer and more fruitful lives. But it also means they're more likely to be having sex. You know, because when you're rail thin and covered in sores, you're not getting laid much, frankly. So people are now more sexually active when they're infected with HIV. Drugs do make you slightly less infectious or considerably less infectious. But we're seeing evidence that new infections are increasing as treatment increases, yes.
Because people are not using condoms again.
Yeah.
Because they don't see any problem.
That's right. They're not scared.
And you've said that our emphasis on patients' rights to privacy has inadvertently damaged our ability to fight AIDS. There is a real balancing act there, isn't there?
Absolutely. I think the equation has changed in recent years because we now have treatment. When the very, very fierce activism for rights to privacy was brought in, became so prominent, we actually had nothing to offer people. So if you got an HIV diagnosis, you were going to lose your job, your health insurance, your friends, your family, and very soon your life. That's no longer true. And therefore, because we've got something to offer people, I think that we need to be applying the basic techniques of infectious disease control that we do for any other infectious disease.
Do you think people should be tested for HIV against their wills or without their knowledge?
No, I don't. But I do think that we ought to be routinely testing anyone who is, we believe, to be at high risk, not against their will, not against their knowledge, but in the full knowledge that we can do something for them. And I think that most people will accept testing if they know the consequences of not being tested and of not getting treatment.
Where do you go from here? You've written a book now after all these experiences. Another book? Another illness?
Time will tell. I like sex and drugs, but I also like eating, so maybe obesity is the next one.
Elizabeth Pisani's book, The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.